Chapter 5, Revelation. My father and I were never close. He seemed incapable of showing love by words or affection. However, he would show love in practical ways, like reminding me to keep the oil in my car fresh. A born mechanic and foreign car enthusiast, he had the whole family convinced that there was not an American car worth owning. We had many foreign cars during my childhood. The one that stands out the most was a hunter green Mercedes with tan leather seats he refurbished. I can still conjure up the smell of the inside of that car and feel the hot seats burning my butt after a full day at the swim club. As a traveling salesman, we got used to seeing him only on weekends. My mom often said, "You didn't know you had a father the first 5 years of your life." He would be exhausted from traveling, but would still conjure up the energy necessary to take my mom out to the local supper club or to dinner parties with their church group. I didn't know it back then, but my dad was a depressive. Of course, this was not openly discussed in our household, but was not something my brother or I could miss, considering he spent a lot of time in bed at Christmas and rarely attended church with us. The father I admired most in the neighborhood was Mr. Kinderdine. He was athletic, like me, and coached his boys' soccer teams. He always seemed to have a smile on his face and direct contrasts to Max, who usually seemed checked out of family life, watched a lot of TV, and spent most of his free time alone working in the garage. I secretly wished that Mr. Kinderdine were my dad. As I got older, I transferred my ideal father onto Michael Landon from Little House on the Prairie. I wanted to be his half-pint, and later discovered that Melissa Gilbert, who played his daughter, was also adopted. Mike Brady from the Brady Bunch was another of my fantasy fathers. He always had the right thing to say during any crisis. Wise and all-knowing, he never raised his voice and patiently instructed his blended family as to right and wrong. Mr. Brady never treated his stepdaughters any differently than his biological sons. In fact, I don't think the show ever once referred to his daughters as stepkids. What all these fathers had in common, besides dark hair and good looks, was their empathetic parenting style. I was desperate for affection and attention from my father, and blamed myself for his inability to provide it. One conversation my dad and I shared has been forever etched in my mind. I was 17, nearing my high school graduation. Sitting in his favorite chair watching TV, my dad asked me to come sit by him. This was highly unusual. I figured this was going to be serious. "I'm concerned that you and Jim are getting serious," he began. Jim was my first serious relationship, and we spent all of our free time together. "Yes," he mentioned getting married once he gets settled in Florida, I replied. "I hope you will tell him the answer is no."
"Why?"
"Because young marriages don't work out."
"How do you know? You and Mom were married in your 30s.
"Because I was married once before. I also have a daughter." His words seemed to suck all the air out of the room.
"Another daughter?"
I was not his first child, as I had believed. But even more distressing than the revelation itself was the disappointment that my father had never kept in touch with his other daughter. It was much more difficult in the 1960s before no-fault divorce to end a marriage, so my father established residency in Nevada. Reno and Las Vegas were known for granting quick divorces and required a short stay to establish residency. As part of the divorce agreement, it was decided that my father would have no contact with his daughter and her stepdad would essentially raise her as his own. I have wondered many times since then how he could have let his first child go and then go on to adopt two more kids. I also wonder why what the cradle thought about this scenario when my parents went through the adoption process. I vividly remember the day my father died. I pulled up to my parents' house on a hot evening in July after leaving the gym and saw police cars surrounding my childhood home. As I walked toward the front, I saw my brother standing in the driveway. He had arrived before me and was attempting to discourage me from walking inside our family home. I said nothing and walked through the front door. I saw a group of paramedics and police congregating in the living room. From down the hall, I could see my mother in my dad's office, which had been recently converted into a bedroom containing his hospital bed. He was lying completely still, his normally reddish face looking white and gaunt. Not wanting to leave his family in a financial bind, he had been maintaining his business while whittling down to a skeleton. This brief viewing of my father was interrupted by the kitchen phone ringing, which prompted me to walk robot-like over the gold carpet with the plastic runner on top to the kitchen wall phone. I had walked this route hundreds, probably thousands of times over my lifetime, but on this day, it felt different. My father was gone, and soon the house would be too.
Max had left the earth without saying he loved me, and although he had a year and a half after his diagnosis, he failed to share any wisdom as to how to live my life going forward. He wanted my mom to move east to be close to her family of origin. What did he want for Scott or I? I picked up the phone. It was a nurse calling from hospice, inquiring about the best time to stop by and see Max. I bluntly and flatly told the nurse, "He's dead." She was profusely apologetic. As I hung up the white wall phone, I noticed the crack in it and remembered that it had been glued back together. Many years before, my dad had been mad about something, threw it against the wall, and shattered it. Max lived longer than the initial prediction that he would die in 3 months. He had a fast-growing cancer referred to at that time as Oat Cell, which our family was told was always terminal. However, he surprised his doctors with a decent remission, allowing him one final Christmas, during which he began to build many Victorian furniture pieces. I have a few of these pieces, as well as a full-size wooden table with a glass top that he built in his basement workshop. After I hung up the phone, I remember my father being wheeled through the living room by paramedics and out the front door. I never saw him again. I remember bits and pieces of the memorial service. We were in the front row of the pew at the Presbyterian Church, and I don't recall any of us showing emotion. I don't recall anyone saying nice things about him, except for the pastor. I don't recall crying. I shook the hands of our friends and neighbors, numbly accepting their condolences. I was 23 and had lost my father before I ever had a chance to really know him. Yet, I could not grieve. I could not bring myself to shed any tears. With my mom's blessing, her family decided to hold a second memorial service in Ocean City, Maryland, so the family wouldn't have to cancel a pre-planned vacation. All it did for me was interrupt the grieving process and remind me that there was literally nobody in our family who could give me what I really needed then, a hug and a listening ear. Once in Ocean City, I was grateful a friend who lived in the D.C. area drove down to be with me. The high point of her visit was attending a Kool & the Gang concert where we were lucky enough to meet the band. Getting lost in the music of one of my favorite bands allowed me to briefly forget I had just lost my father. I felt every song go through me. I experienced the creativity and power of a live musical performance in my soul, akin to how I imagine some people experience mind-altering drugs. I feel at peace when drawn into a musical story. Singing has always given me great joy, and it seems I have an inborn ability to learn the timing and flow of a song quickly. I didn't know it then, but musical ability, as well as putting words to paper, was a genetic inheritance I received from my biological parents. No matter what is happening in my life, song lyrics speak directly to me in mysterious ways. I sat through a second memorial service, numbly trying to listen to my cousin talk about life and death. Anecdotes about my father were missing from his impersonal sermon. It sounded like a bunch of religious word salad with no meaning. Nobody in the family had anything warm to say about him or to me. Rachel had Max cremated, keeping his ashes with her. There is no grave for him, but when my mom passes on, they will be buried in the same plot at one of my favorite places in Dayton. Woodland Cemetery and Arboretum is where the Wright brothers, Irma Bombeck, and other notable Daytonians are buried. Every native tree in Ohio is represented there, which made for an ideal location for school leaf projects. If you drive to the tip top, you can see the Dayton city skyline. After our return from Ocean City, Rachel began giving away and selling most of my dad's belongings. Everything that represented Max was being ushered out of our lives. It seemed that clearing the house of all evidence of our former life was the antidote to my mother's grief. It only made mine worse, as did my mother's strange decision-making. Inexplicably, she had allowed an abusive ex-boyfriend to move into the house while he and my brother repainted it and prepared it for sale. I learned this when I stopped by and saw the man, who came close to killing me on more than one occasion, sitting at our kitchen table with his new girlfriend, like he owned the place. I was incredulous. Not long after Max's death, his mother, my grandmother, died in the Masonic home of Springfield, Ohio, where my grandfather had grown up with his orphaned siblings. Rachel did not mention her death to me until sometime after it happened. There was no funeral or occasion of mourning to mark her passing. We visited the grave a few years later in Pennsylvania, where she was born and raised, and I noticed her death date was never etched onto her tombstone. An air of mystery and incompleteness surrounds that time in my life. It felt as though Max, Francis, and my dad's first daughter all died together.